All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies, our weekly journey into the soul of the Torah portion. Torah portion this week is Behaloscha. You can find it in the Gunnik edition on page 910, 911. 1 year anniversary from Nassan's Bar Mitzvah Parsha. How cool is that? 1 year.
Wow.
Crazy.
Fast.
Way too fast. Sure.
In the Haftarah on Shabbos,
yeah.
It gave the story of Shimshon.
Yes.
But it didn't finish it.
Didn't finish it.
So where will it get finished in the Torah?
We actually don't finish it in the Torah, in the order of the readings. It's in the book of Judges, Shoftim. So it's in the original sources, but it's not a Haftarah. We don't read the entire saga of Shimshon as part of a Torah or Haftarah reading. Yeah. The big finish is left out. It's only the origin story.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, it whets our appetite for more. So the Torah portion this week deals with various themes. 9:10, 9:11. Deals with various themes. It talks about the menorah. It talks about the Levites. We're just going to go through rapid pace. It talks about Pesach Sheni, the second Paschal offering that was brought when a person... The law that was the allowance that was given for those that were impure to bring a Paschal offering, a Pesach, Karban Pesach, a Pesach offering. It talks about the journeying and encampment of the Jews in the wilderness. And then it talks about the first journeys of the Jewish people post Sinai, post Mishkan, post Tabernacle, where the Jews packed up and began their journey toward the Promised Land. Remember, this is still before the sin of the spies, before they were destined and decreed to remain wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. This is when they thought, and all indications were there, that they would go straight into Israel. So they went to Sinai, received the Torah, they had that indiscretion with the sin of the golden calf, okay, whatever. Then they fixed that up, they built a Mishkan, built a tabernacle, and now they're moving toward Israel. And what do the Jewish people do? What do you think they do?
Complain.
They complain. They kvetch. Oi, where's my Uber? Oi, I can't bane on the Beltline. I don't even know what that is. No, but the Jews are kvetching. They're complaining. And things don't work out so well for them. So 9:27 is the first complaint and the first rebuke. 9:29 is the second complaint and rebuke. The Torah describes, shalom, shalom. The Torah describes two episodes where the Jewish people complain. The first one is they complain about the difficulty of the journey itself. Ay, it's too far. We don't like traveling. Where's my upgrade? I thought I had gold status here or frequent flyer. I'm like, what's going on? Who puts us in a desert to begin with? What is this? That's the first complaint. The second complaint is about the food. I mean, things haven't changed. Things literally have not changed in thousands of years. Jews complaining about a trip and about food. Who would have thought, right? It's like, it's right there. Anyway, but these are the two complaints. We're going to focus on the second complaint. And the class is all about temptation and desire. And don't worry, it's not as provocative as it sounds. But nonetheless, that's what the class is about, temptation and desire. So let's focus on the second kvetch, the second complaint. 929 in your Chumash, 929. And so again, just so everyone has the timeline correct here. The Exodus happens. 7 weeks later, the Jews get the Torah. They then, 40 days after that, they worship the golden calf. Moshe spends a few months getting forgiveness. By Yom Kippur, they're forgiven. They're working on building the Mishkan. The Mishkan is put up almost 1 year later, 1 year to the day, almost 2 weeks before that, but almost a year after the Exodus, the tabernacle is put up, and now the Jewish people begin their journeys. If you want to know when it was the 20th day of the second month of the second year after the Exodus, which means the year after the Exodus. It was the 20th day of the month of Iyar. So it was 13 months after the Exodus that these journeys begin. And the Jews begin complaining. One about the travel itself. And the second is about the food. Lisa, please read the second complaint, 929.
The second complaint and rebuke. The mob of Egyptian converts, among them who had left Egypt with the Jewish people, had strong cravings. The children of Israel were also influenced, 929, were also influenced and began to cry with them. They said, "Who will give us meat to eat? You remember the fish that we ate in Egypt for free, the cucumbers, the watermelons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. But now our souls are parched, for there is nothing except the manna before our eyes, morning and evening."
Look at that. You hear the complaint? Look how detailed the complaint. Look how detailed. We remember Egypt was so good. This is literally what's happening. This is the narrative. Egypt, how my soul yearns for those wonderful days, the golden era of Jewish life in Egypt. Yeah, that's what they're saying. In Egypt, we had fish, we had cucumbers, watermelon, leeks, onions, garlic. Look how specific that is. Sounds like a good soup, except for the watermelon and the cucumbers, and maybe the fish. Okay, otherwise, leek, onions, and garlic. I mean, that sounds like a good start for a chicken soup right there. You just need the chicken and other things. Anyway, you know, we have more in the, one there, or in the, you know what, bring out the pile just in case. They're in the machine. So they're complaining, look, we had such good food, and now what do we have? Nothing but this miraculous food that falls from the skies every morning. This miraculous, incredible food. The Torah then proceeds to fill us in about the truth of the manna. Please continue, next paragraph.
In truth, however, the manna was a delicacy. It was round like coriander seed, and it looked like crystal. The people would merely have to stroll around without any exertion and gather it. It would taste of anything one desired, like something ground in a mill, crushed in a mortar, cooked in a pot, or made into cakes. It tasted as moist as oil. When the dew came down on the camp at night, the manna came down upon it.
So the point is, the Torah is clarifying, although they complained about the manna, you should know the manna was fantastic, and it tasted like whatever you wanted, right? It tasted like anything you would desire, whether something ground in a mill, crushed in mortar, cooked in a pot, made into cakes. You want it fried, you want it baked, you want it breaded, you want it boiled, you want it steamed. No problem. It's manna. This is the ultimate infomercial food. It slices, it dices, it tastes like this. It's like you wanted the fish, the watermelon, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. You got it. You got manna. What else do you need? It's like space food. You know, like the frozen, freeze-dried space food. Or they have this new food that they just invented, like a year or two ago. Soylent. You heard about this? It's this food, this superfood. Not a superfood. That's something else. But it's this food that they made, scientifically engineered, that officially, if you just have this one, I think it's a liquid, if you have this one drink, it's like all your stuff is taken care of. Your proteins and your this's and your that's, whatever this and that is. It's all like in one beverage, and it tastes disgusting. But apparently, huh? Unlike the manna, that it could taste like whatever you... But besides that one piece, it's like the future of food, and people are like, yeah, no one's buying it. But anyway, the point is, the manna was amazing, miraculous food, and they're complaining about it. Okay. So here we have this episode in which the Jewish people desire meat. They want meat. The end of the story is, Moshe gets upset. God gets upset, if we can use such terminology for God. And God ultimately sends meat in the form of quail. And quail, the slav, quail descends upon the camp. And the people are fressing. You know what fressing means?
Eating.
Fressing means, but eating in abundance. They're fressing. They're fressing. Like post-Yom Kippur breakfast, you know, with a bagel. It's like they're fressing like they haven't seen food. And the Torah says such descriptive terminology. V'habasar, the meat, was still bein shinayim, something like that, was still between their teeth. The meat was still between the teeth. And God afflicted them. God struck them down with the plague. Those that really craved the meat, those that went after it, and they were cut down with the plague. Okay. So it doesn't end well. That is the second complaint and rebuke. We need to ask a question. What was the complaint about the meat about? What's going on? They had the manna. Why were they complaining?
It was a very spiritual food. There was
But it tasted like whatever they wanted.
No,
what was it lacking?
Well, I mean, there was no waste. It wasn't any human activity involved.
Sounds good.
You know, well, but they were humans.
Yeah, but it's like a superfood. It's like even better. So what could go
so
wrong?
You're saying it doesn't look like anything.
Oh, what did we learn last week about sight? Right, and we learned last week that the greatest pleasure, the sense of our senses, the sense that gives us the greatest pleasure is, according to Judaism, according to Kabbalah, the eyes, the sense of sight. What was the mun lacking? It tasted like anything. What was it lacking? Maybe texture also. But what was it lacking?
Didn't look like anything. Amorphous.
Yes, it looked like one thing, whatever that was. It looked like,
coriander seed.
Well, no, it was round like coriander seed. And it looked like crystal. Yeah, what does that mean?
Clear.
I guess. Clear. It looked pretty. It's good for a display. It's good for a ring. It didn't look good to eat. It's disconcerting. You know, they've done studies in which... this may be... I'm sure it's been done. I just can't think of any actual study. I'm just going to say it as though there's a study and you go with it. They've done studies. Studies have shown that if you're eating something like a flavor... that looks like... No, I know this for myself. Like sometimes the kids, you can buy like candies. Not even like candies, actual candies. That look one color, like one flavor, and they taste the other flavor. And you can't identify it. In other words, you get confused by how it looks. Like if there's a red lollipop, and it tastes... like lime or like apple, it throws you off. And it almost tastes like what it looks, because your mind, your sight is so powerful that it almost influences the way you taste things. And so the manna, fundamentally, it had everything. I'm going to say the lack of waste was a plus. I know there's other teachings that say it was a detriment, but nonetheless, it was the best food, but it was lacking sight, lacking the visual appeal. And so the people complained. They wanted the real deal. They wanted meat that looked like meat. Make sense? You can understand their complaint? I still can't. You know why? They had meat. They had plenty of meat.
Your herds and flocks and...
Text 2. Torah Studies. Torah Studies booklet, text number 2. Ray, page 163, please read. This is... the journey out of Egypt, right here, page 163 in the Torah Studies booklet. This is the Torah back in Exodus, 2 books ago, right after the Exodus, discussing what the Jews took with them.
The children of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Sukkot, about 600,000 on foot, the men besides the young children, and also a great mixed multitude went up with them. And flocks and cattle, very much livestock.
Aha! Very much livestock. Tzon, bakar, mikne, kaved, meod. Flocks, cattle, tons of livestock. What was the complaint about? They didn't have meat? Of course they had meat. They had animals galore. What were they complaining about? What were they lacking? Oh, the manna was translucent. They couldn't see it. It didn't have the visual appeal. What? This is a red herring, right? Although a red herring would probably be good. They would probably want red herring. We remember the red herring that we ate. But I think I'm using the right terminology, right? Red herring is something, yeah? It's like throwing us off the chase. It's like, oh, we need meat because look at all the manna that's there. You have, there. I hear animals. I literally see animals everywhere. There are animals covering the landscape. What are we talking about here? Like, what's the conversation?
Have they eaten from the animals?
I don't know.
They didn't have a shofar with them.
Well, find one. Train one. Get it going. I mean, they had to get the slav somehow, right? They weren't just eating this, I would hope, the quail. I would hope they didn't just, you know, grab quail and eat it. What's going on? I'm sure they had a shofar. What's going on? They had meat. Now, we know that when people are in a complaining mood, like think about kids. Not that kids complain, but just theoretically kids. It's a safe zone to speak about kids right now. When you know, if kids are in a complaining mood, then it doesn't matter what it is, they might complain. So maybe we'll say, well, the Jews were in, maybe they were tired, they slept around, it was difficult, so they're complaining about this also. But even when you're in a complaining mood, in a kvetchy mood, it still has to have some sort of, the complaint has to have some sort of handle in reality. It doesn't seem like there's any realistic grounds to complain. Now, this is not my question. This is Rashi's question, text number 3. Jillian, please read this one, page 164. This is Rashi commenting on the verse in our Torah portion that talks about the complaint about the meat.
Who will feed us meat? Did they not have meat? Does it not say, also a great mixed multitude went up with them, and flocks and cattle? You might argue that they had already eaten them. But when they were about to enter the land, is it not written that the children of Reuben had much cattle?
40 years later, Reuben says, oh, give us land. Remember this? The tribe of Reuben and other tribes, they didn't want to go into Israel. They wanted to stay to the east of the Jordan River. Why? Because this is fertile land, or this is, there's a lot of grass, and it's good for the animals. What animals? The ones that you didn't eat for these 40 years? The ones that you had plenty of, that you were complaining about not having meat when you had all this cattle? What's going on? So Rashi says, Rashi's answer is, well, this tells us that they were complaining, and when they're complaining, they'll complain about everything. But again, my question is, how can you complain about something so obvious? It's like a kid saying, I want an iPhone. I really want an iPhone. I really want an iPhone. And they're holding an iPhone. Right? It's like, if there's a valid complaint, but it's borderline, if the complaint is valid, but maybe they shouldn't be complaining, but you'll say, well, they're complaining, so they're complaining, fine. But it's not even a valid complaint. You're complaining about lack of meat. You have animals. Make it happen.
It'll be like in a few years when Reva opens her closet and says, and there's a closet full of clothes, and she says, I have nothing to wear.
Right. You have all of these clothes, right? So it doesn't make sense. It won't make sense then, and it doesn't make sense now. Right? You have all of these animals, and the animals did not get consumed in the first 13 months of Jewish existence.
So what was manna needed for?
Carbs. No, but other. I don't know if they had everything. They had animals.
Okay, so why?
Why did they need the manna?
Why was it provided?
I suppose they couldn't grow anything. It was just the meat.
Yeah.
It was a
very protein-heavy diet, so this was giving them some extra dosage.
Carbohydrates.
Right.
Carbohydrates.
Yeah.
What is the animal
Maybe.
Feed? That's a good question.
That's a good question. Maybe they eat manna. I don't know. Probably not. I'm sure it's discussed somewhere. By the way, I will tell you that there are commentaries that fill us into an obvious fact that we probably don't think about. And that is that the Jews encamped in the desert or wandering for 40 years, they encountered other peoples and traveling salespeople. And they bought stuff. So it's not like they were isolated for 40 years. They encountered others and there were interactions. So I'm not saying that somebody came along with a patch of grass and said, hey, your animals need to eat. Here you go. Here's a patch of grass. I don't know. It's a good question. What do the animals eat? But anyway, the question is asked. Rashi asked the question. His answer is, well, they were kvetching, they were complaining, so they complained about this. Or they were looking for something to complain about, so they found this. But really the question is, what's going on here? Why complain about meat when there is literally animals right in front of them? So what we're going to do now is switch gears. Put this question aside for a moment. And let's explore a seemingly different topic. Seemingly different topic, and we'll see soon how everything comes around. What is the seemingly different topic? It's a discussion that Maimonides has about what is the ideal attitude that a person should have. What is the ideal outlook that a person should have about right and wrong? Should a person not want to do the wrong thing? Or should a person want to do the wrong thing and hold themselves back from doing the wrong thing? In other words, is temptation a good thing or a bad thing? Is it better for a person not to be tempted at all in the negative, or to be tempted and still overcome that temptation? Which is the greater temperament? Which is the ideal temperament of a human being? The opposing force, the animal soul.
I was actually reading this morning an additional reading in, I think it was additional, or maybe it was one we hadn't read, you know, and this idea that how can, you know, so what makes a person righteous? Are they righteous because they never do anything wrong? Or are they righteous because they are tempted with evil or wrongdoing, and they're able to elevate themselves above it?
Exactly. And this is discussed at length in Kabbalah and Hasidic philosophy. The truth is, Rambam discusses it also. Rambam would not call himself a mystic. Nonetheless, even within the realm of Jewish philosophy and teachings, you have the same duality or the same discussion about, well, what is the ideal? Is the ideal the chassid, if you will, the pious individual that's not tempted at all, or the individual who is tempted and overcomes temptation? So let's see how Maimonides articulates it, text for a mic.
Philosophers have noted that a person who overcomes his inclinations may act favorably and respectably, but deep down still desires evil. He defies his natural feelings, which is for him a painful process. Conversely, a pious person is naturally drawn to good.
Let me just step in for a second. So Rambam quotes the philosophers. Is Amru ha-philosophim. That's in the Hebrew. Philosophim. You see it right there. So he quotes the philosophers. And he talks about two types of people. The person who overcomes the evil inclination, the negative desire, who, although is doing the right thing, still has evil and desire for evil inside somewhere. On the other hand, you have a pious person naturally drawn to good. And the question on the table is, who's greater? Who's on a higher rung? Why do we care? We don't care. But he's talking about it, so we're engaged in the conversation.
The consensus among philosophers is that the naturally pious individual is more respectable and healthier than he who must overcome his inclinations. This latter individual may be pious in certain ways, but he is inferior to the naturally pious individual by dint of the fact that he has that desire for evil in him, even if he doesn't act on it.
So again, possessing the evil desire, even without acting upon it, puts a person, according to this initial understanding, under the person that doesn't have that temptation or desire for evil. So the chassid, amu'ula, the pious, righteous individual, is greater than the kovesh et yitzro, the one who has to conquer the inclination. Thus far. Make sense? However, we have a fascinating story from the Talmud that sheds, perhaps, light in a different way, in a different angle on this discussion. Text 4b, Talmud Tractate Sukkah. Sarah.
Abaye,
yeah.
Once heard a certain man say to a certain woman, "Let us rise early and go on the road." On hearing this, Abaye said to himself, "I will go and accompany them and prevent them from violating the prohibition that they certainly intend to violate."
So again, he hears... So he hears a man say to a woman, "Hey, let's go on a road trip." And Abaye's thinking, "Really? Road trip? Come on. There's no such thing as a road trip." So he's like, "I'm going to chaperone this thing." But he doesn't tell them that he's chaperoning. So what does he do? Continue.
"He went after them for a distance of 3 parasangs."
Yeah. I just imagine him lurking behind, like they look around. Oh, he's behind the trees, behind the bushes, right? He's behind, and they're traveling. right? I don't know why they're traveling. No, literally, they were traveling, and he's lurking behind, but nothing's going on. Continue. Yeah, parsa. Yeah, parsa.
What is it equal?
It's a per. It's a person. What is it?
Parsa is a hoof.
Uh-huh. No, it's. Oh, maybe.
It's a measure.
It's a measure. Yeah.
Also a hoof.
Oh, that's what it is. Also interesting.
A hoof of
an animal. Interesting. Same word. Interesting. Maybe it's related to horse travel, right? Some sort of measure of a hoof's travel. Look, I've seen it translate as a Persian mile. I don't know if that's accurate. I've seen it translate as a Persian mile. And I don't know what the Persians count as a mile, but it's not exactly the same as ours. But anyway, he was a certain distance behind. He could see them. They couldn't see him. And nothing happened. Continue.
When they were taking leave of each other, he heard that they were saying, "We traveled a long distance together, and the company was pleasant company."
We had a good time. That's it. Very innocent. It was nice. I had a great day. So did I. Beautiful.
Abaye said, "If instead of that man, it had been one whom I hate, a euphemism for myself."
In other words, he was saying, if it would have been me traveling with her, continue.
He would not have been able to restrain himself from sinning. After becoming aware of so great a shortcoming, he went and leaned against the doorpost, feeling regret.
Abaye is saying, I don't know how this guy did it. Had it been me, there would be no chance. I would have definitely, not just traveled together. Continue.
A certain elder came and taught him. The greater the person, the greater the inclination.
So the elder tells him, don't worry. You're feeling bad because you know that would have been a tremendous test for you that you might not have overcome. The greater the person, the greater the inclination. So it could be this person didn't have such a temptation, doesn't have such a yetzer, such a desire, such a temptation, but you, Abaye, you're such a great person that you have a greater commensurate to your greatness. You also have, and the side of good, you also have a great desire on the other side toward other things. And therefore, that's what you're feeling within yourself, that you might not have been able to overcome that temptation because indeed your inclination is very strong in this area. And that kind of made him feel better. The greater the person, the greater the inclination. Right? What do they say? The bigger they are, the harder they fall. But this is before the fall. The bigger they are, the bigger is the temptation that could lead to a big fall. Make sense? Yes? That's a story. Based on this, Rambam continues text 4c. 4a was Rambam's initial approach, saying that it would seem that if we were ranking human beings, which by the way I mentioned before, why should we rank human beings? We shouldn't. We shouldn't be saying, well, this person's here. Nonetheless, Rambam is saying prototypes. What is a greater measure? Why he's discussing which is greater? Who knows? But if we were ranking it, we would have put perhaps the chassid, hama'ullah, the esteemed, pious individual above the one who has to conquer the inclination. Now we may have a different perspective on this. 4C, Karen.
Upon comprehensive research of the sages' works on this topic, we will find that a person who is inclined to sin and desires sin is greater and more complete than he who does not have such desires and who feels no pain in abstaining from sin. Indeed, the sages have said that the greater and more whole a person is, the greater his passion for sin, and the greater the difficulty in abstaining from them. Furthermore, the sages have said that the reward for controlling one's desires is commensurate with the pain involved with doing so, and said the gain is according to the pain. What's more, the sages have enjoined us to desire sin. A person should not...
This is next level stuff. So what we said up until now, let's just break for a second, is that Rambam says, upon further analysis, what we thought was our 1-2 ranking is actually reversed. The individual that feels temptation that's an indication that they are a greater person. The greater your inclination, the greater your yetzer, the greater your susceptibility to sin, that means the greater person you are, or the higher, loftier individual you are. The greater the person, the more whole that person is, the greater the passion for sin, and the greater the difficulty in abstaining from that sin. Right? According to the pain is the gain. So therefore, the greater the person, so the person that has a temptation for evil, for sin, for negativity, that indicates that that person is actually at a higher standing than the person that does not have that inclination at all. I'll tell you a story about the Rebbe about this in a moment, but let's finish this off.
What's more, the sages have enjoined us to desire sin. A person should not say, I have no desire for this sin, even if it were not forbidden by the Torah. A person should not say, I have no desire for meat and milk together. I have no desire to wear forbidden mixtures. I have no desire for forbidden relations. Rather, a person should say, I desire all these things, yet what can I do if my Father in heaven has forbidden it to me?
So Rambam says, it's better to say, I would really want to do it, but I can't, than saying, yeah, I don't want to do it anyway. So wool and linen garments? Don't say, well, the Torah says no, but I don't really care to wear it. It's not like I ever looked for it. Oh, it doesn't have wool and linen, forget it. I can't be cut with that wool and linen together. Right? If you should say, no, you should say that. I do want wool and linen, but what can I do? My hands are tied. The Torah says not to. God doesn't want me to. That's how we conclude. So being the tzaddik, the chassid, being the individual that says, I don't want to sin, Rambam says, that's not the ideal. The ideal is desiring sin, desiring the opposite of God's will, and yet withholding oneself to do the right thing. Why is it better? So we need to look at this from a few different angles. Number one, let's analyze the first point that Rambam makes, which is, and the Talmud says, quoting the story of Abaya, that the greater the person, the greater the inclination. So I'll tell you a story. Fellow was struggling with a certain temptation, a certain thing in his life. And he went to, it was a very big struggle, and he went to the Rebbe for advice. And he bared his soul. And he thought, you know, telling such a great tzaddik, such a great person, his temptation, his challenge, he would be judged and maybe looked at with disdain and contempt and whatever, like, how dare you tell, you know, want that or be. And the Rebbe looked at him and said, I'm jealous of you. That was the last thing he expected to hear. I'm jealous of you? I just told you all my deep dark secrets, and you're saying I'm that you're jealous of me? Like, what does that mean? And he said, what do you mean? And the Rebbe explained. He said, God only gives a challenge to a person God only gives a person a challenge with that a person has the strength to overcome. Not that they overcome every challenge, but they have the ability to overcome that challenge. That's what we believe. So if God has never given me your challenge, that means that God doesn't believe that I could overcome it. But God gave it to you, which means that God believes that you have a strength that I don't possess. Because you have that strength, I'm jealous of you. That's how the Rebbe flipped it, you know, to empower this individual to feel empowered to conquer the temptation. Not to feel bad about the fact that they have the temptation, but to feel empowered to overcome it. And it's akin to what the Rambam says. The greater the person, the greater the inclination, because they have a greater strength. Therefore, as we've learned in other classes and as we know in general, everything, the ledger always has to be balanced. So if you have a person with tremendous spiritual gifts, they also will have tremendous physical temptations, if you will, or whatever, materialistic temptations, commensurate to that typically. Why? Because everything has to be balanced. So the greater the individual, the greater the yates or the inclination, the temptation to sin. So that's how that works. That's the first point. As he develops it further, it also seems like what we're saying is that there is an advantage in putting down the temptation over not having dealt with it at all. Right? The reward for controlling one's desires is commensurate with the pain involved in doing so. So in other words, there's a reward. There's always a reward in doing the right thing. But if that right thing is the product of intense effort to do it, because you had to push back against something that was really opposing it, and you had to push it down, and it was very hard, the greater the effort that's exerted, the greater the accomplishment therein. Right? So that's the second point. The first point is about the nature of the individual. The nature of the individual is that the greater the person, the greater the inclination. And the greater the inclination, then in the case, the greater the person. So know that you're a great person. You have a temptation. What does that mean? You're a great individual. And you have strength. That's what the man told, that's what the elder told Abaya. You feel bad that you were tempted in this scenario, that if it would have been you, you don't know what you would have done. That means that you're a great person. You have a great temptation? Mazel tov. You're gifted spiritually. The second point is that when we feel the temptation and we fight against it to push it down, the greater the fight, the greater the reward. So let's explore this now. This point in the book of Tanya is developed by the Alter Rebbe. Let's take a look at text 5a. Hold on. Karen, you just read, right? Okay, so David, please read text 5a, page 169.
If, however, sadness stems from the fact that sinful thoughts and desires enter his mind, then know this. If these thoughts occur to him not during his service of God, but while he is occupied with his own affairs and with mundane matters and the like, he should, on the contrary, be happy in his lot. For although these sinful thoughts enter his mind, he averts his attention from them. By averting his mind from sinful thoughts, he fulfills the injunction, "You shall not follow after your heart and after your eyes, by which you go astray." The verse surely does not speak of tzaddikim, referring to them, God forbid, as going astray, but of Benoni, like himself, in whose mind do enter erotic thoughts, whether of an innocent nature or otherwise, and when he averts his mind from them, he fulfills this injunction. Our sages have said, when one passively abstains from sin, he is rewarded as though he had actively performed the mitzvah.
Thank you. So what the Alter Rebbe is referring to is, and it's not from chapter 2, it's in the 20s, it's either 27, 28, or 29. Anyway, the Alter Rebbe is referring to a situation where a person feels bad about having temptation for negativity. In other words, the same thing we're talking about. A person like Abaye who feels, Abaye was a tzaddik, but he felt like, you know, maybe he would have been tempted or something. A person that feels bad or depressed about temptation to sin. So the Alter Rebbe says, don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. On the contrary, be happy. Why be happy? Because although you may have a thought to do something not kosher, you nonetheless don't do it. And when you don't do it, when you feel like you want to do something, and you don't do it, then that is fulfilling a mitzvah. V'lo sasuru achre levavchem v'achre einechem. It says in the Shema, do not turn and follow your eyes and your heart. Who is that talking to? The tzaddik? The tzaddik is not tempted by their eyes and heart. It's only talking to a person that is tempted. So a person says, "Oy, why am I tempted? Why do I have all these thoughts and desires and inclinations?" And the Alter Rebbe says, be happy. Now you have the opportunity to reject it. And in doing so, you fulfill the mitzvah. Look, that's one of the 613 mitzvot. A tzaddik can't fulfill that mitzvah. A tzaddik can't do this mitzvah of feeling temptation and pushing it down. Only the Beinoni, the individual who feels, the Beinoni in Tanya is pretty much the same, or like the prototype of Rambam, the individual in Rambam who has the temptation and who desires evil but rejects it. So it's the same type of prototype. In Tanya he's called the Beinoni. So the Beinoni is somebody who wants to do something wrong, but pushes it away. And in doing so, the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, in doing so, they fulfill the mitzvah of not following the heart and the eyes by which you go astray. A tzaddik can't do that. And so his point is, don't feel sad about the temptation. Feel glad about the mitzvah opportunity. So that's one text. Text 5b takes it to the next level. Saying that when a person pushes down the negative temptation, not only is it fulfilling the mitzvah of not following after your heart and your eyes, but moreover, it causes this cosmic chain reaction of light that is greater than any other thing. Text 5b.
This is due to the desire of the Benyonim and their task to subdue the evil impulse and the thought that arises from the heart to the mind, and to completely avert his mind from it, repulsing it as it were with both hands, as explained above in Tanya chapter 12. With every repulsion of this thought from his mind, evil is suppressed here below in this world, inasmuch as the arousal from below produces a corresponding arousal above. Evil above in supernal worlds, the root of evil of this world is also suppressed.
In other words, when a person pushes down their negative inclination here, in one moment when a person has a temptation but says, you know what, I'm not going to follow it, he says what that causes is a chain reaction on the highest of spiritual levels, that all of the elements of evil and negativity in the world are also on some level pushed down. By one act of pushing down one temptation in one individual, that causes a cosmic chain reaction to push down evil on every level, also down a notch. Continue, please.
Indeed, the Zohar extols the divine satisfaction that occurs when evil is subdued here below, for thereby God's glory rises above all, more than by any other praise, and this ascent is greater than all else.
In other words, God's glory is revealed, the God's light is unleashed to a greater extent when one subdues their yetzer, their inclination, more than any other thing. That's an amazing statement. That comes from Zohar, straight up Kabbalah. When a person pushes down the sitra achra, their individual other side, sitra achra, which we talked about last night, istalik yikar the kosher bricha b'chol amin, then God's glory is revealed throughout all the worlds. That's what it says in Zohar. That's an amazing concept. That only happens when you have the temptation. If you never had the temptation, you couldn't knock it down. What are you knocking down? You don't want to do it. You don't want to wear woolen linen together. So what are you rejecting? What are you pushing down? And if you're not pushing it down, where is God's glory? How is that being revealed? Continue.
Thus, it is the evil thoughts that enter the mind of the Benyoni that enable him to fulfill God's command in averting his attention from them, thereby subduing evil. Therefore, one should not feel depressed or very troubled at heart, even if he be engaged all his days in this conflict with the thoughts that will always enter his mind. For perhaps this is what he was created for, and this is the service demanded of him to constantly subdue evil.
And he says at the end here that a person, throughout their entire life, they may never conquer their evil inclination. They may always be faced with the same or similar temptations for their entire life, every single day. And a person might say, I'm not making any progress. And the Alter Rebbe famously answers, something we've talked about many times in many different classes, that the objective or the goal of the Beinoni is not perfection, but process. It's not about getting to a destination of purity and righteousness. It's about the experience of consistently pushing down the temptation. And every time you push it down, that's your purpose in life. Your purpose is to be a soldier, to fight and to battle. It's not to conquer, it's not to win, it's to constantly battle.
I keep hearing, though, that it's your thoughts, not so much your action, like Benyonim's not going to act on it.
Benyonim might want to act on it.
Yeah, but is the Alter Rebbe talking about being able to, if a thought comes into your head and you can chase it away?
Yeah, with two hands. You know why he says with two hands? Doche b'shtei yadayim, two hands. Why? Because sometimes we say, no, with one hand, but the other hand, right, it like gives a wink, like, I wouldn't, if you really insist, fine. But no, right, wink. And then, but, so he says, no, two hands. Two hands means really, like legitimately I'm pushing it away.
That I can see how you'd have to do that constantly, because it seems like something's going to pop in your head.
Yeah. No, what he's saying, yeah, exactly. What he's saying is when a temptation comes to mind, so it pops in your head, and and you might be encouraged to think about it and to act on it, and whatever he says, push it away. And even though you might feel bad that the thought even came to mind, like, why am I thinking, what does it say about me that I even was thinking about such a thing? I didn't do anything, but I'm a terrible person for thinking it. He says, you're a terrible person. Why are you being so judgmental about yourself? You're not a terrible person. You're a person that the Torah is talking about. You have the opportunity to do a mitzvah. Number one, lo taturu, no, lo sasuru. Don't follow, don't be led astray. Who's that speaking to? You! You have a mitzvah opportunity. Mazel tov, you did it, you achieved, you did it. And this is the purpose of all existence, of all humanity, which is to push down, except for tzaddikim, which is to push down the evil inclination that lifts itself up, to push it down. It's like a game of whack-a-mole. Right? The purpose is not to get down all of... The purpose is not to stop them from popping up. It's to knock them down when they pop up. Does that make sense? It's a big game of close the pop-ups on your browser. Back in the day before they had ad blockers, which thank God they have. Right? It's like close one pop-up. Right? And it's constant. And the other person says, but you're never going to win. And he says, that's the point. There's no winning. Winning is in the moment. It's in the every battle. Every moment. Every time you're faced with temptation and you say, no, I'm not going to do it, you just won. That's it. It's victory.
So you want to remind me with the pasuk?
Yeah.
La fetach hatat obet.
Yeah. At the... So sin crouches at the door, waits for you. Yeah.
And you will master.
Yeah, v'hu yimshabach. It's telling you that you should. In other words, that you can.
Yeah.
So God was telling Cain that, yeah. God was. It's the first counseling session in history. Cain is depressed and he's upset and he hates his brother and he hates his life and he hates God. He hates everything. God rejected his sacrifice. God likes his younger brother better. His younger brother is the favorite. He's the goody two shoes. He gave a better offering than me. Blah 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 blah. He wants to kill him. And God says, don't be upset, don't point fingers at anyone, own it, recognize that you have a temptation, and you have the ability to control it if you so choose to exercise it. And I think that's a great point. The point is that you will always, for most of us, we will always have that sin waiting for us right there. And the goal is, push it away with two hands. So what's the point of all of this? The point of all of this is, again, that if we had to assess what is a greater quality, an individual who has no temptation, who lives a temptation-free existence, or the individual that feels the temptation but rejects it and quells it and pushes it aside, which is a greater life, which is a more accomplished life? The latter, not the former. Now we understand why the Jews asked for meat, but first.
But no, I was just going to say, didn't we study something too in the Ten Commandments where we talked about thou shalt not covet?
Yeah.
And we studied something about thinking about coveting was in some ways more evil, or there was a level.
Because now it's in your head.
Because now it's in your head.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
We talked about that, right? It was like about a year ago.
Yeah.
And so it fits into this. Quite nicely, this idea.
The temptation that's in the mind.
The temptation in the mind, the thought that's in the mind.
Right.
And having to constantly battle that.
It almost could do more damage than just doing something. Because just doing something, okay, you got out of your system.
Right.
But the thinking about it,
right.
That's, you know, it could be stuck in the head. Yeah. So based on all of this and the value in feeling the temptation and then pushing it away. Now we understand what the Jews wanted on a deeper level. This comes from the Sfas Emes, the Sfat Emes. Sfat Emes explains that when you look at the verse, take a look at text number 6. Take a look at text number 6. And you should know that text number 6 is the same text that Lisa read all the way at the beginning. And, yeah, let's read it. Peter. Text 6, page 172.
But the multitude among them began to have strong cravings, and even the children of Israel once again began to cry, and they said, who will feed us meat?
So look at this. That's the verse. A little bit different, little bit of a different translation than what we had in the Chumash itself, but basically the same thing, right? The Jews are traveling, and now they desire meat. The language of the Torah, v'ha safsuf, the multitude, asher b'kirbo, that was within them amongst the people, hitavu tava. What does that mean, hitavu tava? In the Hebrew, a tava is a desire, a craving, right? They desired or craved something. But what does it mean, hitavu tava? So the way it's translated is they had a strong desire, not just once, but they use the same word twice. The Sfat Emet says, you're missing the point. Sfat Emet says, that's not what happened. Hitavu tava means they desired a desire. Not they had a strong desire. They desired having a desire. They wanted to have a desire. It's different. The basic translation is, they had a really strong desire. They had a really strong craving. The Sfat Emet says, no. They wanted to have a desire. They desired a desire. Which means, they didn't want meat. They were, again, this is a completely different way of understanding the narrative. Throw everything else you know about the story out. Look at it from fresh eyes. The Jews were spiritually elevated. They had received the Torah. They had done tshuva. They had repented. They had built a mishkan. They weren't kvetching. Like we understand it simply. They were elevated. They had no desire for meat. They desired a desire. They wanted to have a desire for meat. They wanted to enjoy a steak. Why? So that they could reject it. They wanted to have a physical temptation so that they could experience the virtue of feeling the temptation and pushing it down. Otherwise, they had no temptation. They weren't desiring anything, so they didn't have the opportunity to push down their desire. So they desired having a desire. Does it make sense? Let's read it in text 7. Such a daring interpretation.
Yeah.
Right? Totally different. Take a look at text 7. Here it is inside. 173. On the verse, who will feed us meat? Rashi asked, but doesn't the verse say also a great mixed multitude went up with them and flocks and cattle? But what kind of pretext could this have been if they in fact did have flocks? The answer is that the verse says, hitavu tava. This can be read as they desired a desire. In other words, they lacked desire, for they were above nature and had freedom from the evil inclination. Therefore, it seemed appropriate to them to desire, so as to merit bringing pleasure to God by eating physical meat in a holy fashion. In other words, they wanted to be tempted, and then still push down the temptation and do it for the right reasons. They wanted to have a physical craving for meat to then say, no, I'm only eating it, l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven. They wanted, in other words, they had meat, they had animals. They weren't asking for animals, for meat. They had all the animals. We asked the question before. They said, where's the beef? Moses could have said, in your backyard, that's where the beef is. You want meat? You got it. What are you asking? They weren't asking for meat. I know we have to now explain how the slav, how the quail came down, and why it came down. Okay, whatever. We'll deal with that. Well, run out of time. We just ran out of time on that one. But the point... Oh, well. But the point is like this. They had meat, but they didn't want to eat it. What do spiritual beings have to do with meat? But they want to stand over a grill and grill meat, a barbecue meat, or slow cooked beef for 18 hours. They had no desire. Slow pulled brisket, they couldn't care less, right? Barbecue short ribs, they didn't care, right? Chuck the chuck, they said, we don't want it. So therefore, they asked Moses, we want a desire. We want to want, so that we can then reject it. Sounds like a very holy experience.
Is this another example in a way of God's second gift, God, in a way? He set it up so they wouldn't.
So hold on one second. So the Sfat Emet makes it sound like they were, not only makes it sound, he says they were very spiritual. They were the chassid of the Rambam. They were the tzaddik of Tanya. They had no physical cravings for meat. They wanted to crave meat so that they could experience pushing that craving down and only doing it for the sake of heaven. So what was the problem? Why did God and Moses get angry at them? The answer is, you don't ask for a challenge. Sorry, for a test. You don't ask God for a temptation. That's not good form. It's not smart to ask God to pile on more challenge or more temptation. It's like, God, you know, things are a little too easy. Can you give me a really big challenge? That's not good form, and it doesn't work. Take a look at text number 8. Text number 8. Everyone had a chance. I'm just going to read through a bunch of texts here. Text number 8, 174. Rav Yehuda says that Rav says, a person should never bring himself to undergo an ordeal, as David, king of Israel, brought himself to undergo an ordeal and failed. David said before God, Master of the universe, for what reason does one say in prayer in the Shemona Esrei, the Amidah, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob, and one does not say God of David? Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, we say in the Amidah, but we don't say Elokei David. He says, why, how come I didn't make the cut in the prayers? Why don't we talk about the God of David? So God said to David, they have undergone ordeals before me. In other words, they passed tests. And you have not undergone an ordeal before me. You haven't passed any tests. Abraham was tested. Isaac was tested. Jacob was tested. David, you haven't been tested. This is what it says. David said before him, so examine me and subject me to an ordeal. As it is stated, examine me, God, and subject me to an ordeal. Try my kidneys and my heart. He doesn't mean, try them out, see what you... He means, test them. Test my inner metal. Test my dedication to you. My righteousness. God said to him, to David, I will subject you to an ordeal, and I will perform a matter for you that I did not perform for the patriarchs. As for them, I did not inform them of the nature of the ordeal. While I am informing you that I will subject you to an ordeal involving a matter of a married woman with whom relations are forbidden. In other words, I'll take you up on the offer and I'll give you a test. But I'm going to tell you what the test is, and you still won't be able to pass it. The verse states, and David walked upon the roof of the king's house. From the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very fair to look upon. And it is written further, and David sent in and inquired after the woman, and one said, is this not Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him, and he lay with her, and then she returned to her house. And that is the meaning of the verse. You have proved my heart, you have visited me in the night, you have tried me, but you find nothing. Let no presumptuous thought pass my lips. David said, oh, that a muzzle would have fallen upon the mouth of the one who hates me. A euphemism, again, for his own mouth. And I would not have said anything like that, and I would have withstood the ordeal. David ultimately regretted the fact that he asked God to test him. Right? Like Houdini that said to the person, hit me. And didn't make it. I don't mean to make light of that, right? David says to God, test me. And he did not pass the test. At least the way the story looks on a plain level without getting into a deeper analysis of the King David story.
But it's interesting. He knew what the test was going to be.
And he still, right, at least on the surface, on the surface appearance, did not pass that test. And he said later on, according to this teaching that comes from the Talmud, he later on said, oh, I wish that I had muzzled my mouth. I had not said anything. God, test me. Because I want to be included in the prayers or whatever it is on that level. So what's the message? The message is, if you're not tempted about something, don't tempt fate and ask to be tempted. It's not wise. David tried. David asked for temptation, asked for a test, and he didn't pass it. So the message for us is that the Jews that asked for the temptation for meat, they should have rather enjoyed the lack of temptation. Because God gives us temptations regardless. Unless you're a tzaddik, God gives us temptations. Right? God gives you and I temptations. We don't have to ask for more. You don't have to ask, hey, you know, if things are boring, make it more exciting. That's not a wise thing to do. Text 9, Every morning we say this, right in the morning prayers, the first few pages of the Siddur, it says the following: may it be your will, Lord our God and God of our fathers. And then it lists a bunch of things, and one of them is, do not bring us to a trial or to a disgrace. Lo lidei nisayon. Do not give us a challenge. We ask God, don't test me. Don't test us. We don't say, test us. We say, don't give me a nisayon. The understanding is that God will give us a test regardless. God, you know, things are challenging for us regardless. But we ask God to not give it to us or to lessen them. Finally, I want to conclude with this. An unbelievable teaching. Maybe we'll do two more. Text number 10. This is from the Ten Commandments. Commandment number 2. Let's read it inside. You shall neither prostrate yourself before them, other gods, nor worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a zealous God who visits the iniquity of the fathers upon the sons, upon the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. Okay, forget the second half. The first half of that commandment, second of the Ten Commandments that the Jews heard at Sinai from God himself. Lo tishtachaveh lahem. Do not bow down to them, other gods. V'lo ta'avdeim. And don't worship them. The Ishbitzer Rebbe says, text 11, you shall neither prostrate yourself before them nor worship them. So he says it means two things. Do not prostrate yourself refers to anything that is contrary to what God wants. In other words, prostrate means don't do what God doesn't want you to do. That's one. God commands us to overcome the challenge of our inner urges. So that's the first half. Don't prostrate yourself to them means don't follow the temptation. But do not bow down to them means we shouldn't deify. We shouldn't make our inclinations into an avodah, into a worship for him. I.e., we shouldn't try to evoke our desires and then try to overcome them and thus serve God in that way. Don't deify or glorify temptation and say, I need more temptation. That is my avodah. That is my service of God. I need more temptation so that I can put it down. No. When it happens, don't prostrate yourself before it, but don't lo ta'avdeim, don't worship it. Don't make it into a glorified thing that I need to find more of. I need to have more opportunities to experience God and the divine in the process of quelling the evil inclinations. Make sense? So the Jews said, give us temptation. We desire a desire, right? Let's give me a temptation for meat. Moses says, bad idea. God says, bad idea. And they were given meat. This is probably the answer. They were given meat. And they didn't pass the test.
So what happened to them?
Some of them died. It was a plague that broke out, the Torah says. I'll give you the final tally soon. We'll look back inside. We'll see how many lost their lives. Text 12 is a Talmudic story of two people that tempted temptation and passed the test. But the point is that they were the exceptions to the rule. The last thing is text 14. I'm going to read this. The Rebbe says that when Moses commanded the Jewish people about building the Mishkan, he gathered the men and the women separately. He didn't gather everyone together and tell the entire nation about the building of the tabernacle, the Mishkan. He gathered them in two distinct groups. Why? Let's read text 14. On the verse, and Moses gathered the entire congregation of the children of Israel. The Zohar states, this refers to the men, for Moshe spoke to them separately. The Zohar infers from the word B'nai Yisrael, the sons of Israel, that the verse refers to the sons of Israel and not to the daughters of Israel. But the Aruch Haim explains that this doesn't mean that Moses only spoke to the men and not to the women. Rather, that Moses gathered the men separately, B'nai Yisrael, and the women separately. The reason was to avoid temptation, etc. The lesson is, some people want to do, in the Yiddish, I'm sure it's a kunz, yeah, kunzen, tricks. They want to mess around and put themselves into tempting situations with the attitude that without temptation, it's no big deal to do the right thing. So let me make it more difficult for myself, right? Therefore, they claim it is necessary to go to tempting places and to refrain even there from forbidden behavior, and that, they believe, will be an impressive feat. So let me go into the lion's den and still survive, and then I am a very worthy individual. My father-in-law, The Rebbe once spoke about a person who says, "What's so impressive about sitting in the Beit Medrash in the study hall? Rather, we must go out into the street and even there act appropriately." Then he takes a step further and he says, "What's so impressive about just going to the street? Better to go to the theaters and refrain even there from inappropriate behavior. And this will demonstrate true strength. For after all, the Mishnah says, who is strong? He who conquers his evil inclination." And then this person takes it a step further, and even goes to places that are forbidden by the laws of modesty. And even that is not enough. He wishes to behave in the way the Talmud talks about repentance, that true repentance is when one finds himself, quote, with the same woman at the same time, etc. In other words, the Rebbe is quoting his father and says, some people say, to stay in the Beis Medrash, away from temptation, that means I don't have strength. I'm going to go out into the streets, and then the theater, and then forbidden places, and even intentionally commit indiscretions, so that I can then rebound and be stronger than ever before. And that's the response to this attitude is, nobody needs such impressive feats. You don't need to be that strong. You don't need to be that powerful and mighty. Each and every Jew asks God in the prayers not to bring me to a test. And certainly it is forbidden to place oneself in a tempting situation. And we find regarding King David, who brought himself to a test and failed. Certainly, we are not expected to be greater than King David. After all, if a person is a notch lower than King David, the Rebbe says, be a little, right? Even King David couldn't do it. You don't have to be greater than King David. This then is the lesson. Even when there's a need to gather Jews for building the Mishkan, the tabernacle, which is the highest purpose, the purpose of all creation. And what's more, the gathering is done by Moses, by Moshe, and it happens on the day after Yom Kippur when we're all like angels. Nevertheless, it was necessary not to gather the men and women together. You would think if there's any time that you can have this conglomeration, this intermingling of men and women and nothing would happen, it's gather for a holy cause by a holy person the day after the holiest day of the year. You would think that this would be a kosher circumstances, or if you were tempting fate or testing your own mettle, this would be a good opportunity to test how strong you are. And the Rebbe says the message is, we still don't put ourselves in a challenging situation intentionally. This is a lesson for all times. When Jews gather together for whatever purpose, it is forbidden for them to enter into tempting situations. Specifically with this approach, it is possible to bring the divine presence into our midst. So the point of this is, that, number one, we should all know that when we have temptation, we shouldn't feel bad about it. We should recognize that it's an opportunity to do a mitzvah, namely the rejection of that temptation. It means that we're human. It means that we have a mitzvah opportunity. It also means that when we do that, it means that we have the opportunity to release and unleash the greatest light in all of the universe and to bring down the collective force of negativity one notch down. At the same time, we don't intentionally enter into that situation. We don't try to stack the deck against us to then overcome it in a greater measure. We take what we got, what we have, we take what we get, we take the temptations that we're faced with, and we fight against them, but we don't poke the bear or the lion or whatever animal it is that is dangerous, right? We don't provoke the evil inclination. It's not good form. So what's the takeaway? Don't poke the bear, that's too negative. The message is, let's appreciate the test that we have and do our best with what we've got. And don't ask for more.
Is it better to sit in the yeshiva or go out on the street?
What was the question?
Is it better to sit in the yeshiva or to go out into the streets? So the Rebbe said it in a bit of a sarcastic fashion about the person who says, let me go out into the street so that I can face temptation. And then I'll go to the theater and then go, etc., etc. So it seems like the Rebbe is advocating, stay where you are in yeshiva. Yet in other talks, the Rebbe clearly said that we have a mission to make the world a better place, and that means that we have to go out into the world. I don't think there's a contradiction. To go out into the world doesn't mean that I'm necessarily setting myself up for an intentional challenge in a specific area. It sounds like this is a specific situation where a person is saying, let me set myself up for a specific temptation and still I'll overcome it, and with that I'll achieve this strength of character. And the point is, you want to achieve a strength of character, walk on hot coals in Arizona or whatever, wherever they have those workshops, but don't tempt yourself. I don't know. whoever that guy is that does that.
Tony Robbins.
But you want to grow, buy a self-help book, but don't, I mean, I'm kidding, don't necessarily, whatever, do whatever you want, but don't put yourself intentionally in a specific challenging situation. Yeah, but don't. But don't necessarily stay in yeshiva. Stay in yeshiva, but out of the four walls of yeshiva. That's what I would say. You can take the bachur out of yeshiva, but you can't take the yeshiva out of the bachur. All right, thank you for joining me tonight for another wild and woolly episode of Torah Studies.